Some people thrive on being the center of attention. They love to be at the heart of any activity. They like to be up on stage and having the applause and adulation of their fans. I'm not one of those people. I'm much more retiring than that. And though for the last 9 years I've spent almost every Sunday having to stand at the front, it's something that never gets any easier, and that more often than not I'd rather be sitting in the pew than standing up here. And I get the sense that in some respects the Apostle Paul was the same. He wasn't someone who was seeking attention for himself. He wasn't someone who delighted in the praise and the adulation of the crowds who often gathered around him to hear what he had to say. Paul was the kind of man who wanted to blend into the background. But he also was a man who was taken up with the glory of Christ and the desire to thrust Christ into prominence. And that's what we find him doing here again as he stands as the center of attention in the dock, as it were, as he is brought before Festus and then before Agrippa and Bernice and the other noblemen who have gathered in Caesarea. Paul has become the center of attention once again. In fact, we can say more than that. We can say that he's become something of an object of curiosity. People are puzzled about him. They're intrigued about him. They're not sure what to make of this strange character who has become such a thorn in the side of the Jews, as has become obvious. And there's a number of reasons why the Apostle Paul has become an object of curiosity as he stands before this assembly in Caesarea. One reason is because of where he is. He's there in Caesarea under house arrest. And he's been there for more than 2 years. We're told there at the end of chapter 24, having been taken by Festus to Caesarea, and by Felix rather, to Caesarea, and going there regularly before Felix to be examined, Paul's been there for 2 years until Festus succeeds Felix. For 2 years, under arrest. This is something to make him something of an object of curiosity. Why is this man there? Why for 2 years is he under arrest? Why brought before Felix time and time and time again? Why is he in such a predicament as this? The crimes he must have committed must be serious for him to have been imprisoned for so long. And yet they cannot have been serious because he's under house arrest, not chained in a dungeon somewhere. What a strange situation. And so Festus finds him, a man, a peaceable man, a man who's not out to cause offence, not out to cause trouble. And yet here he is, a prisoner. Why has Felix kept him in bonds for so long? Why has he been imprisoned for these 2 years or more? And so Festus inquires of him. The Jews have petitioned him that they want him to bring Paul to Jerusalem. Their reason for that is it will give them an opportunity of assassinating him as he travels that road over the mountains from Caesarea to Jerusalem. They'll set an ambush and kill him. They had planned to do it 2 years earlier. 40 or more men had taken a vow that they would eat and drink nothing until Paul was dead. I wonder where those 40 men are now. Did they keep their vow, or were they absolved because of those changed circumstances? A friend of Paul's had heard the plot, discovered what was going to happen. Had gone to Paul, had warned him. Paul had told him to go to the centurion. The centurion had taken Paul at night to Caesarea before anything could be done to fulfill that vow. And now, 2 years on, they're still plotting against Paul. They're not content to have him out of Jerusalem. They're not content to have him imprisoned in Caesarea. After all, Paul's allowed to have visitors. Paul's still preaching the gospel. Paul's still doing what he's been doing for years and years. He's still turning the world upside down, much to the disdain of these leaders of the Jews. And so they want Festus, the new ruler for the Romans in Judea, to bring Paul to Jerusalem. That way they can have him assassinated. But Festus isn't one to be bullied just immediately on taking up his job. He's not one to be pushed around by the Jews, as much as he may want to show them a favour later on. He's an astute politician, and he's very wary of causing trouble. He wants to follow the book. The seat for judgment for Rome in the area was in Caesarea. And so in Caesarea, Paul will be judged. And so a couple of weeks later, Festus goes down to Caesarea and takes with him a number of Jews who accuse Paul. They make all kinds of accusations, we're told. But none of them could be proven. Accusations about the temple and its desecration, I imagine. That's what he was initially charged on. But it couldn't be proven that he had desecrated the temple. Accusations against the God of Judaism. But nothing would stick. Accusations that Paul was someone who was dangerous to the Roman Empire. But even this charge couldn't be upheld. And Festus is puzzled. He tells Agrippa later on that the accusations that were brought against him weren't things that he supposed they would bring. He's first informed about Paul by the Jews in Jerusalem while he's visiting that city. And the impression that he is obviously given is that this Paul is a serious malefactor. He's a serious criminal. And that's probably partly why he wouldn't bring Paul to Jerusalem. No, if he's such a serious criminal, he must be charged and arraigned before the court in the proper manner, in the proper place. But when this all happens, he finds that the charges aren't that serious after all. And in the end, it boils down to interpretation of the Jewish religion. And so he offers for Paul to be taken to Jerusalem, where he can more properly be tried by a Jewish court under his supervision. Festus is puzzled by this man imprisoned here in Caesarea for 2 years. How does Festus view Paul? Well, to him, he's just a harmless eccentric. This is his statement. Paul, you are beside yourself. Much learning is driving you mad. You know, the picture that those words conjure up is of this, this crazy inventor kind of picture. You know, the old English eccentric, fiddling about in the shed at the bottom of his garden with all kinds of crazy ideas. Or the strange professor in his study, having read so much and learned so much that he's become no practical good to the world. This is what Festus is. He's just a harmless eccentric. He's got some funny ideas. But that's all. There's nothing to get upset about. Why bother with him? You know, he's hopeless. He's got these wacky ideas that are going to go nowhere. That's Festus's judgment. An object of curiosity. Another reason why he's become this object of curiosity is because of who he is. Because of who he is. He's portrayed as being a leader of a sect of Judaism. That's the way that he's presented. And this is the way that King Agrippa sees him. Agrippa is the great-grandson of the Herod who murdered all the infants at the time of the birth of Jesus Christ. He's the son of the Herod Agrippa, who earlier in Acts is described as having been eaten by worms because of his opposition to God and his boasting of his own achievements and his own abilities and greatness. He's a puppet king for Rome in among the Jews, who has taken it upon himself to study the Jews, to understand their religion, to understand the people, so that he can better rule them in a way that's not going to stir up trouble in Judea. He is, after all, basically a politician. He's out to further his own ends, to save his own skin. And this is what he so ably does. Bernice, who's with him, is not his wife, as it might be easy to assume from the way that it's written here. He's actually his sister, though Calvin says that she was rather familiar with him as her brother. She's the widow of her own uncle, apparently at the time in the family of Herod. Many of the nieces were married off to their uncles to keep power within the family and to pursue their own desires to rise within the Roman Empire. And so it was with Bernice and Herod. So this King Agrippa and Bernice, brother and sister, who have come down to Caesarea to pay homage to Festus, to get into his good books. Festus is ruler over the part of Judea in which they, Agrippa at least, is king, though Bernice is also described as being queen of that area. Festus's region is much broader, much wider than Agrippa's, but Agrippa is under his authority. So he comes and he tries to get into Festus's good books. But Agrippa is called upon by Festus to explain what it is that's going on here. Why are the Jews so angry against Paul? What is it that? Why is Paul such a cause for concern? Though initially it's Agrippa who voices his desire to hear. Oh, this sounds interesting, he basically says to Festus. This man imprisoned for 2 years and it's just something to do with the Jewish laws and Felix didn't bring this to a conclusion. This sounds interesting to me. Someone who talks about the Jesus who was crucified some years ago. Yes, I heard that story, that some of them claimed that he had risen from the dead. It was all the talk of the city at the time. Well, Agrippa knows all of these things, you see. Paul makes reference to it, doesn't he? He says to him, you know these things. None of these things have escaped your attention, Agrippa. You understand what I'm talking about. And so Festus calls for Paul to be brought before King Agrippa, and Agrippa listens to what Paul has to say. He hears about his early life, born a Jew, raised under the strictest sect of the Pharisees in Jerusalem, a zealot for the Jewish faith, and then a change in his life, a turning point, when he comes face to face with this man, Jesus of Nazareth, whom he claims to be God. And from that point on, rather than persecuting the church, Paul has become one of the greatest advocates of the church. And Agrippa listens to all of these things, and he weighs it up with what he's heard before and the rumours that have been circulating and the things that have been taught over the years. And Paul claims before Agrippa that he's done nothing but what has been done for years. For centuries, in fact, he's teaching the same thing that Moses and the prophets taught. He's making a reference there to the Old Testament, the law and the prophets. He's saying he's consistent with all of that. He's not teaching any new thing. Everything that he says can be based upon the Old Testament scriptures. And Agrippa sees him then as just being a leader of a sect of Judaism. He may not be mainstream. He may not have the favour of the Pharisees, but then neither did the Sadducees for that matter. It was a fragmented existence there in Jerusalem. If you were a Jew, who did you follow? Did you follow the Pharisees, the great law keepers? Did you follow the Sadducees? Did you follow the Herodians, great pragmatists, when it came to living at peace with the Romans? Who did you follow if you were a Jew at Jerusalem? Well, some of them were following this teaching of the way, the teaching that saw Jesus Christ as the fulfillment of the messianic prophecies. Paul was a leader of this sect, and a great preacher as well, and a persuasive preacher of this gospel that they proclaim. King Agrippa says, after hearing all that Paul had to say, "You almost persuade me to become a Christian." Or a better translation of the Greek would be, "Given time, you would even try to persuade me to become a Christian." Agrippa's in no danger here of giving in to Paul's arguments. That's not the thrust of what Agrippa's saying here. What he's acknowledging is that Paul is persuasive. He's acknowledging that Paul's arguments are strong. He's having nothing to do with them, but they're strong arguments. You know, you can't argue against what Paul's saying here. You can't go to the Old Testament and say, "Well, Paul, you've got it all wrong." Paul's taking it straight out of the Old Testament. This is the problem, isn't it, that the Jews have. They could never argue against Jesus Christ as the Messiah from the Old Testament. He fulfilled all the prophecies. He did everything that Moses and the prophets said must be accomplished by the Messiah. They didn't like to acknowledge it because they had twisted the Old Testament scriptures and had thought of the Messiah as being a deliverer for physical Israel from its Roman occupation. This wasn't something that they wanted, a suffering Messiah, a Christ who would suffer, a Christ who would die, or of course rise from the dead as well, but nevertheless a Christ who would die. It's not him, and furthermore, not a Christ for the Gentiles as well as the Jews. But this is what the Old Testament professes, that the seed of Abraham would be a blessing to all nations, that the light that came through Israel would shine out to the Gentiles as well as to the Jews. But this was something the Jews didn't want to hear. They didn't want to know. This was a message that they weren't in agreement with. But Agrippa, he wasn't in with the Jews to the extent that he was going to support everything that they said. He saw all the factions there. There was no way that he could keep all of them happy. He just saw the way. Christianity as being just another segment, another fractured portion of the Jewish religion. A persuasive preacher. But no one to really take seriously. No one to get uptight about. An object of curiosity. Just someone to listen to and be amused by. Object of curiosity. Here's a third reason why he's an object of curiosity. It's because of what he is. He's a Roman citizen. He's a Jew, but he's a Roman citizen, born a Roman. And in the midst of these accusations that have been brought against him by the Jews, and the failure of the Roman governor in the region to bring justice, Paul, a Roman, has had to call upon all his rights as a Roman citizen to find justice. He's a Roman citizen who's obliged to claim his rights for nothing, for no reason. Both Festus and Agrippa agree this man is doing nothing deserving of death. The Jews are calling for him to be executed. He's done nothing deserving of death. He's not even deserving of chains. He doesn't even need to be in prison. The man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. What a strange situation to be in. A man whom the greatest authorities in that region of the world pronounced innocent has had to call upon Caesar. And furthermore, he's had to call upon Caesar because of their own unwillingness to go against the wishes of the Jews. Because they were out to save their own skin. Paul, you see, was going to be brought to Jerusalem. He hadn't forgotten the plots and plans of 2 years earlier. He hadn't forgotten that the Jews were out to kill him. And he saw these plots and schemings as just another way to see him in his grave. And he says to Festus, very boldly he says to Festus, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I offended in anything at all. I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged." Not in Jerusalem. At Caesar's judgment seat as a Roman citizen. "To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. If I am an offender or have committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. If you can demonstrate, if you can uphold the claims of the Jews and justly sentence me to death, I've got no objection to that under Roman law. No problem at all with a just sentence of death against me. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them." You're not just going to palm me off on them. Just send me packing to be dealt with by them at their mercy. No, I appeal to Caesar. I'm a Roman citizen. I should be treated justly. Festus just wants to get rid of this problem. He sees what Felix has done. Felix procrastinated, didn't want to upset the Jews in fear of an uprising that would see him frowned upon by Rome. And Festus inherits this difficult situation. He is a man who's done nothing deserving of death or of chains, but the whole Jewish nation seems to be against him, a force to be reckoned with when you're wanting to advance in Rome. And Paul is forced, under these circumstances, to claim his rights as a Roman citizen. He calls and appeals to Caesar. As a Roman citizen, he must therefore be taken to Caesar. And so it is pronounced, you appeal to Caesar you will go. So this Paul is the centre of attention, the object of curiosity for two or more years. He's a harmless eccentric, a persuasive preacher, and a Roman citizen forced to appeal to Caesar for no good reason. But what can we learn from this portion of God's word? Is there anything for us to take away from here? Any Roman citizens here? Well, the Roman Empire is long since gone, hasn't it? Such is the way of history. But the way continues. Christianity continues. Throughout the world, there are those who call upon the name of Jesus Christ. Throughout the world, the message which Paul preached in chains in Caesarea is preached today. The same gospel, the same message. And notice the way that Paul presents this message, even while he's in chains. He gives it a very personal touch. He doesn't just talk in terms of theories. He doesn't just say, well, here's the doctrines that you need to know and understand. Paul makes it personal. He describes his own conversion. He talks about the way his life was changed. It makes it clear that he stands as someone who has been personally affected by an acknowledgement of Jesus Christ as the Son of God and the truth of the message that he brought. And he applies it personally. He calls on these people. He says, I would to God that not only you, but also all who hear me today might become both almost and altogether such as I am, except for these chains. This isn't something simply to do with a knowledge, with an understanding of certain facts. It's not points that you'd write up on a blackboard for people to learn and be able to recite by heart. Well, Agrippa could have done that. He understood the Jewish religion. He knew what the various sects of Judaism taught, what they believed. But it didn't make him any more a follower of the living God than Festus, who didn't know it all. The gospel is personal. It affects people in their hearts, in their lives. And Paul demonstrates this by using it as a key to his evangelism. He does it here before Agrippa. He did it before Festus. He did it before Felix. He did it before the Jews in Jerusalem. He's done it throughout his life. A number of times we have Luke's account of his conversion experience, and we can be sure that if he gave it that many times that it's recorded 3 or 4 times in the book of Acts, he must have given it many, many more times that are not actually recorded for us, because the gospel is personal, and our evangelism, our taking of the gospel to other people, must be done personally with our own conviction and applied personally to those who will hear us. So that's one thing to learn from this, the personal nature of the gospel and its spread through the world to other people. The second thing to learn from this passage is that those who serve God will be hated. They will be hated. Paul here, hated without a cause, we might say. They said this man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. Well, he would have been set free to go to his death, wouldn't he? Because he was hated. Festus and Agrippa agree. Hated without a cause, perhaps, but nevertheless, hated. And of course, it was Jesus who himself said that he was hated without a cause. If I had not done among them, he says, the works which no one else did,
they would have no sin, but now they have seen and also hated both me and my Father. But this happened that the word might be fulfilled, which is written in their law. And he quotes the Psalms, they hated me without a cause. And that Jesus speaks those words in the context of talking to his disciples about hatred. He says to them earlier on, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. Don't be surprised if the world hates you. It hated me. And these disciples could look back after the death of Jesus. Remember, he spoke those words before his death. They could look back afterwards and see the truth of it. Hated without a cause, even to death. Paul's seen it. He saw it in the death of Stephen, whose execution he stood on and observed and witnessed. He's seen it himself in his own life. Time and time again, he's been beaten and stoned and brought into all kinds of difficulty because of the hatred of sinful men against those who preach the truth. If you're a Christian, if you serve God, expect to be hated. We bring a message of love and forgiveness, but it requires a change in people's lives that people don't want to make. And they hate it, and they hate us because of it. And the third thing to learn from this passage is that our suffering is for Christ. It's for Christ, but it doesn't rule out using natural means for justice, as Paul does here. He's suffering here for Christ. He's suffering at the hands of evil men who hate Jesus Christ. But he uses everything in his power to ensure that he is treated justly according to the law of the land. And we suffer for Christ, and we will suffer for Christ. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't stand up for our rights as citizens of this country in which we live. The right to be able to worship God freely. The right to be able to evangelize at the moment, for the time being. For how much longer, who knows. But at the moment we have this right, and we should use this right. And when we're opposed, we should call upon our right to use this privilege to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. Paul used it here. He wanted justice to be served for himself. He didn't want to be buried before his time. He was quite happy to be killed. That wasn't a problem for Paul. He's given ample evidence of that. But nevertheless, he knew that if he was released then and there, he would be handed over to the Jews to be killed. By appealing to Caesar, by appealing for Roman justice to be honoured, he may have kept himself in chains, but he kept himself alive for a few more years to continue to preach the gospel, to continue to write letters, to continue to serve Jesus Christ. And he had actually written to the Romans concerning this, the authorities that are there to bring peace, and they're there to bring justice. And he says in Romans chapter 13 that we're to submit to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. For, he goes on to say, that authority is God's minister to you for good. It's there to uphold peace, it's there to uphold justice, it's there to uphold the rights of its citizens. For Paul here, he could appeal to Caesar for justice to prevail in a situation where injustice was taking place. And so it is with us. But I fear that often we don't use our rights, do we? We don't use the freedom that we have today. We're almost ashamed of the gospel. We don't proclaim it boldly. We're not willing to be the center of attention for Jesus Christ. We're not willing to be an object of curiosity for the sake of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Paul used all of these means as a forum for explaining the gospel, for preaching Jesus Christ. Do we do that? Are we willing to do that? Or are we reticent? Do we prefer to hide in the shadows, to not confront sinners with the gospel, to be non-entities in this world? Jesus said we're to be lights, lights shining on a hill. Jesus said we're to be salt, salt that's effective, that works in the community. We're to be proclaimers of the gospel of Jesus Christ in word and deed. Do we do it? Will we follow Paul's example and be willing to be an object of curiosity for the sake of Jesus Christ?